Hello, welcome to the LaRouche Show for Saturday, July 19th, 2014. This is Michelle Steinberg of Executive Intelligence Review hosting the show today on a timely and explosive subject of economic development versus drug legalization. To give you a little background, back in the late 1970s, EIR published a groundbreaking study, a full-length book called Dope Incorporated, Britain's Opium War Against the United States. The book has been a bestseller, and it's gone through four editions, a dozen printings, and translations into multiple languages. It established for the first time something that is now completely recognized by government leaders, by mayors, by citizens all over the world, that it's the banks, stupid. Without the international banks facilitating and protecting the movement of the money for, quote unquote, the world's biggest cash business, there would be no way that drug cartels, no matter how well armed and well equipped, no matter what country they were from, without the banks, these cartels could not continue the drug trade. The international drug trade has been a policy of the British Empire since the 18th century. It was made famous in the Opium War against China in the 19th century, and that is true today as well. This time, not through gunboats, but through the international banking system. That's what's on the line today. The LaRouche Show's guests today are two of EIR's leading researchers and organizers of the fight for economic development and against legalization. I want to welcome Roger Moore from EIR's European Center. Roger, are you with us?
Yes, thank you.
And Gretchen Small of our Ibero-American desk, here in Leesburg.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you both. And listeners, as these guests are going to tell you, these two concepts, development and drug legalization, represent two different irreconcilable worldviews. Or, as it was discussed last night in the weekly LaRouche Political Action Committee Friday night webcast, it's the battle of worldviews between Prometheus versus Satan. Today, the United States under Barack Obama is on the wrong side of the battle. Mr. LaRouche has repeatedly underscored there's only one way out of this crisis, the impeachment under the U.S. Constitution of President Barack Obama for his many crimes. We're going to focus today on one aspect, a big aspect, Obama's war against development and Obama's ushering in drug legalization. Under Obama, the United States, as a British puppet, leads the world, as the British Empire did throughout the 19th century and early 20th centuries in legalizing drugs. Let me say that again. Today, the United States leads the world in legalizing drugs. Under Obama's war on terror, so-called, in Afghanistan, the opium production there has increased many, many, many fold. And at the same time, instead of working against the opium industry and the heroin industry, Obama has put Russian anti-drug leader Sergei Ivanov, one of the world's most competent leaders in understanding how to stop the narcotics trade, on a sanctions list. Obama has cut off crucial cooperation between the United States and Russia against the drug trade. Barack Obama is also on a collision course with the very countries that should be our leading allies in development, Russia and China. At the same time, the Supreme Court of the United States has taken the side of the vulture funds, speculator banks that feed off the misery of the people of developing countries. The Supreme Court's taken the side of the vulture funds against Argentina, which took on the International Monetary Fund and the casino banks some years ago and put its people ahead of paying the debt to the bankers. Well, much of this battle came to the surface this week in an extraordinary series of meetings in Ibero-America around the sixth summit of the BRICS, that is, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. We're here today, that is, LaRusso, myself, Gretchen Small, Roger Moore, to get the United States on the right side of the battle where it belongs. So, to do that, you listeners, EIR subscribers, followers of the LaRouche movement, you have to be involved. And we're here to give you whatever background we can on how to do this. So, my first question is going to be for Gretchen. Gretchen, fill us in what happened at BRICS Summit number six, and how does it reflect Lyndon LaRouche's work over the years?
This was the biggest blow to the British Empire in decades. And what we have in front of us is the germ of the possibility of actually ending globalization. I mean, what you had is half of humanity, the representatives, the leaders of half of humanity came together and sat down and met from Sunday, and they're finishing up the Xi Jinping, the Chinese president's trip to Argentina, is still finishing today. So Sunday to Saturday, a full week of meetings between the leaders of all of South America, the five countries you mentioned, Brazil, India, China, Russia, South Africa, and a couple from Central America, and the Mexican president thrown in. Right, and you had a Caribbean government represented also. And what they came together to say is the current world order is unacceptable, and they are uniting their forces to change the current world order, both the financial architecture, the economic policy premises of it, and the political military relations against it. I mean, one of the most beautiful summaries or sort of captures of the spirit of the discussions throughout the whole week and all these. You had a meeting, just to be clear, you had a meeting Tuesday, Wednesday of the BRICS proper, right? Tuesday was all those five leaders together. Wednesday was them together, but again, then with all the South American presidents. But around that, the Russian president met with the Chinese president, met with the Brazilian president, met with the South. They all had cross bilateral meetings along the way. On Thursday afternoon, there was a meeting then between the leadership of the community of the Latin American and Caribbean states, which is basically the representatives of all of the Western Hemisphere, minus Canada and the United States, with the Chinese President Xi Jinping. And the title, they what their final communique summarized the subject of their discussion as their a commitment to develop their relations on the basis of, quote, equality and mutual benefit, reciprocal cooperation, and common development. And that, which is, I might say, those are the principles upon which the United States was founded. That's what John Quincy Adams' principle of community of principle for basis of foreign relations stated. That is the Treaty of Westphalia, right, in all its aspects. That characterizes the totality of the week. Now, what they came together, the BRICS themselves formed a new development bank, which is going to start with 50 billion and go up to 100 billion. It's going to be based in Shanghai. The Indians are going to be the first presidency. It has a first regional office to be set up, started immediately in South Africa. And the South African finance minister was ecstatic. He came out and sent the message to all the African nations that he expects that some of their first lending will be for the infrastructure development of Africa, which so badly needs it. So this is
Wow,
a
yeah.
global project you're looking at here. And then it'll go from 50 to 100 billion, right? And the specific, now that's going to come online, they hope next year. Right, but they're moving on it, and they're all the back and forth and the who wants to be the head and who's going to be the capital and all that, but they forced it through and made their adjustments because they knew they had to make this statement to the world that they're serious about carrying it through. There was also a contingency reserve fund that's a pool of $100 billion to defend each other against a currency attack. These are statements of intent. But the kind of then physical economic production to which this is tied is really tremendous. Infrastructure was all over. The Chinese proposed to the Peruvian and the Brazilian presidents they form a trilateral working group in order to complete, because there's very little parts of it done, complete a transcontinental railroad which would connect the Atlantic ports of Brazil all the way over to the Pacific ports of Peru. Right, that would be the first of many projects that have to be done.
Wow, this sounds like things that Abraham Lincoln thought of in the United States
Right, this is what
150 years ago, right?
the railroad route was designed by under McKinley
Wow, okay.
in the US. These are the projects that needed to be done, have to be done, and no one has been put in to do it. Right? The other thing that is really critical about it is their complete commitment to actually going high tech. This was space cooperation, this was nuclear cooperation across the board between different nations. The South.
Tell us a little bit more about the nuclear, because what you're describing, I've been following this, of course, but it reminds me this wasn't a talking heads meeting. There was a lot of actual bilateral and multilateral projects finalized on the sides of this of these meetings, right?
Well, yes, exactly. Like, for example, Russia's meeting with Brazil beforehand, which includes a cooperation on nuclear. The Chinese-Brazilian discussions beforehand, which included cooperation on nuclear. The Argentine, actually, the Russians met with the Argentines. Putin met with Cristina before he even went to the summit. And they have nuclear cooperation, and Xi Jinping is there afterwards, and they're discussing nuclear cooperation. So, and the South Africans going into it announced that they have decided they're going to go ahead with their six nuclear plants. So this is an explosion of something which I think the speech given by the new Indian Prime Minister Modi was most beautiful in that sense, because he went in and said, look, the BRICS is a unique institution of governments in the world because it's not defined by our current existing, what currently exists, and it's not, we're not joined by our ethnic agreements. I mean, this is a pretty wild combination of nations if you think about it. It's four continents, right? It's 43 or 48% of the world's population. But he said it is defined, the BRICS is defined by future potential. And his big focus there was on the question of the youth. And this, I think, when we get into the discussion, Michelle, we really want to come back to this because the question of the youth is the question of the drug trade immediately. And he just said in the case of India, 65% of the population is under 35. He was elected. He's from the BJP party, but he was elected. He's a total new phenomena on the basis of putting promising and commitment to development, as that has to be the agenda of the nation for the youth. And he went to the youth, and the youth massively put him in. That's his base of support. I was talking to Tanu Mitra, our correspondent from India, about this after his trip, and he was just emphasizing that. But that identification of the future potential. Now, to give you one other taste before we go on to other things of where this could go, Vladimir Putin in his speech to the BRICS said, we have shown that we're committed to doing things. Everybody said that they founded the bank to show that they weren't just, they talked about it last year and then they founded it this year, right? That they're going to be a said and done organization, as Xi Jinping would say. But the Putin, when he came, said, look, one of the things the Russians put on the table here is that we have to discuss setting up an energy, common energy policy and common commodities policy. He said, because we have 30 to 60% of the world's minerals and raw materials in our countries, and we need to coordinate policy on that. We should set up an institute. We should set up a fuel reserve bank. Now, if you think the cartel headquarters didn't go berserk over that one, because if you return sovereign control, see, I guess that's the other thing you have to understand. The tenor of all the discussions, the underlying premise, is that nations must control their economic future.
Right.
And it has to be advancing. And that means they're going to rip it out of the hands of the neoliberal financiers, Wall Street, London speculators that have been looting everybody. So that's sort of the gist of it. The one other thing, just to identify, and we can come back to that, it's interesting that the Modi went in and put very heavily an emphasis on the need to jointly work on Afghanistan, on the drug problem, and against fight against terrorism, something which the Russians are gung-ho on, and Roger knows quite a bit about that. And that we have a report just now. I mean, Viktor Ivanov was with Putin at this BRICS meeting, and they agreed to set up a BRICS working group to fight against drugs, which is going to work both on Afghanistan and South America. So it's a retaking of initiative of nations against the empire.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you mentioned Ivanov. Sorry about that. That was a cough break. You mentioned Ivanov and being there with Putin and a working group. I'm going to bring Roger in now, because this is absolutely crucial to the point. One thing that strikes me about BRICS, India, China were the victims of the British 19th century opium war. It was brutal. It was horrible. There's a modern book out. It's a novel. It's called Sea of Poppies, and it's, you know, a whole fictional thing, but it's based in India, and in it you have a fight between the Indian nationals and the British poobahs, whoever they were, who were running the shipping companies, and the fight about free trade. And it's hilarious, not hilarious, funny, but it's just so vivid that free trade had to trump national identities. And we have a lot to discuss about the enemies of humanity who've been pushing these ideas of destroying nation states, including, Obama's a kind of minor player. He's a newcomer. He's a joke in the, when it comes to the British monarchy, Tony Blair, and people like that. But he is president of the United States, and that wields a lot of power. But India, China were victims of the British opium trade. Russia, of course, has one of the highest addictions in the world, and the Afghanistan opium has been, in large scale, directed to killing off the Russian youth, at least mentally, if not physically as well. Roger, you've been following and talking with Yes. international anti-drug experts like parliamentarian and former UN official Pinar Arlaki, Russia's Ivanov, UN anti-drug chief Antonio Maria Costa. Tell us about their work. What is the U.S. missing out on right now? How dangerous is the Obama policy of legalizing drugs?
Well, I think I'd like to actually start with building on something that Gretchen mentioned about the, I believe it was a government representative from Honduras, about just how decimated the youth are from their involvement in criminal gangs of one sort or another, and the relation of that to the so-called immigration crisis on the border of the United States and Mexico. Because the Russian experience is it's been at least a year or two now, but certainly for several years with Viktor Ivanov, the head of the Russian Federal Drug Control Service, that the Russians consider the damage done to their country, and in particular to their youth, over the course of the 1990s when their drug problem first began, unlike our generation in the United States where it started in a big way at the end of the 60s, into the 70s, and then into the cocaine phase in the 80s, Russia was, the Soviet Union, and then Russia was relatively speaking, compared to, say, to the U.S., drug-free. And then they got hit by the shock therapy. They got hit by the globalization. They got hit by the system of privatization of, you know, anything goes, and then they developed among their youth. For Viktor Ivanov and for President Putin, combating the drug traffic, and particularly the Afghan drug traffic, is a national security issue. I think, and I would hope, that perhaps this immigration debate, and who knows what's cooking in the ghettos and the poor areas of the United States, where the cocaine has been historically flooding in for decades and decades, and where nothing is done in any serious way against the money laundering component, which permits the accumulation of massive financial reserves to do things like, you know, organize the youth of Central America into gangs of one sort or another that are also involved as a part of the cocaine flow up then into Mexico and then into the United States. This could very be, it's a good reason why the United States should listen to what the Russians and Viktor Ivanov have to say, because they consider it a national security issue. Already back, I believe it was in his speech in March, Viktor Ivanov, as you remember, or let me just reference this, because the Russians take this so serious, they've had there's been a million drug deaths in Eurasia. That is, drug deaths largely related to the heroin epidemic, as NATO has been sitting there since the end of 2001 up to this day, doing nothing against this 30-40% increase in the heroin economy. And it's a heroin economy that's a Eurasian heroin economy. The money that stays in Afghanistan that Afghani criminals or perhaps Afghani farmers get is a minuscule percentage of it. Most of it is money. There's probably several 10 billions of money alone earned by criminal gangs, largely Russian, but also Central Asian, who are supplying this massive Russian addict population for opiates. So Ivanov already had been preparing for when Russia was to have headed the G8 meeting. And of course, because of the Ukraine crisis, the way that was built up as a flank to bust up other things that could have gone on between the United States and Russia, that had been going on around Syria, that had been going on around Iran. Then suddenly we had the Ukraine crisis, and then suddenly we had no more collaboration with the Russians, and we put Viktor Ivanov and many other people on the sanctions list, on the persona non grata list of the United States. And that blew apart the fact that Russia was to have headed the G8 meeting in June, just weeks ago. There should have been a meeting in Sochi, and Viktor Ivanov and President Putin had put on the agenda to confront the G8, which is not exactly the best of the world. The Chinese are not a part of it. The Brazilians are not a part of it. But that the G8 should have put on the agenda.
And the British are a part of it, which really makes
sense. Yeah, and right. So they sabotaged the G8 thing. But in his speech in March, where they presented an NGO that we know something about in Moscow presented a development perspective for Afghanistan and Central Asia, Ivanov came out and said quite explicitly, actually, the G8, we don't consider much to come from the British. And frankly, he didn't make it explicit, the United States. But what he did say in his speech, and this was a speech which should have had the interior ministry officials of the G7 countries that were a part of the G8, they all should have been there. People from the Justice Department, from Homeland Security, from the DEA should have been there. People from the British side, from the German side, from the French side, from the Italian side. They all should have had their anti-drug people at this meeting that was being coordinated by Ivanov. They weren't there because of the boycott, because of the sanctions. And what he said is, but our experience shows, this is a literal quote, that it makes more sense to rely primarily on the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and those countries that are neighbors of regions of drug production. So I think it's still early to see what might come out of this on the anti-drug side, but I don't suspect we should have any doubts that the Russians, the Chinese, and the Indians are preparing a major surprise for the British policy, which is goes back to the British-Afghan wars. They were perpetually running wars there. It was a playoff of their opium trading policy in the 19th century that they got started in these Afghan wars. And we know the British and Brzezinski getting the Afghan war started again in the form of a drug war, of a narco-terror war in the 1980s with the Mujahideen. That's when heroin got started in Afghanistan. So I think the Chinese with the new Silk Road, the Russians, and hopefully West Europeans with the Eurasian land bridge, development policies, that is those that relate to Eurasia and Central Asia, are going to have to, and they are planning to confront this massive 60, just conservatively, $80 billion, and that's really conservative, but that's the figure that Ivanov uses, heroin economy based in Eurasia. Because they're not going to get anything in terms of the Eurasian development perspective, that side of the BRIC development perspectives, unless they take this on. And I'm quite excited that that they've got major things planned in various venues, be it the BRIC, be it the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, be it the other venues that go on that have to do with Central Asia. And the real challenge, and that's why Viktor Ivanov says, I've got a lot of friends in the United States. And we have to remember that Senator Dianne Feinstein, for better or for worse, but for better in this case, who's had her fights with the CIA and all kinds of other things with the Obama administration, in January of this year said, we must, because it's a disaster what has gone on under our NATO presence and our largely American troop presence in Afghanistan. It's a disaster, and we have to work, despite all differences, with Russia and with Iran. Iran is also a major victim of this decades-long policy of promoting the heroin economy in the midst of Central Asia, infecting all of Eurasia. So I think Viktor Ivanov, in addressing the fact and keeping the pressure up on the United States, and coming off of the BRICS situation, which is also going to have a lot of people in London, has to have a lot of people in London and Wall Street and Washington extremely nervous, that this security issue of not dealing, let alone going for legalization, but not dealing with the national security implications, and legalization is a national security implication, it's a disaster for the United States, to legalize the people who are flooding the poor areas of the United States with heroin. You've got a major heroin boom going on, even out into the suburbs in the United States. And this could explode politically as a, Ivanov calls it, the Russians call it a national security issue, but for the U.S. So the U.S., as it liberates itself from this British-American, this Obama-Anglo policy, is going to have to go and work with the BRIC, and the allies of the BRIC in Latin America, and with Russia, China, and India, if it wants to do anything useful regarding the mess that it's leaving behind in the course of withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. So I think this national security issue for the U.S. and the Russian lead on this, and now the BRIC being explicitly a part of this, even though the Russians and the Chinese and the Indians have been talking about this for months and years, actually, we've followed this progression of events that are now led to the BRICS setting up a coordinating body with all of its members to tackle the cocaine and Afghan drug production centers.
Absolutely. Gretchen has something immediately to throw in on this.
There's a lot of There's a lot here you've identified. I can tell you one thing. The commander of the U.S. Southern Command, General John Kelly, absolutely agrees with Viktor Ivanov that this is a national security question. The combination of the immigration and the drug crisis, which is one crisis. I mean, there actually is no immigration crisis. What you have is a breakdown of the nations south of the border and of the United States itself. And that the attempt to pit Americans driven mad by the destruction of our country against people fleeing from absolute hell south of the border, created by drug gangs that are among the most bestial in the world. This can be broken up, and this has to be broken up. But what John Kelly said very recently was that he said, look, this is an existential crisis, what is happening on the border, because let me just read it. In comparison to other global threats, the near collapse of societies in the hemisphere with the associated drug and immigrant flow are frequently viewed to be low importance. Many argue these threats are not existential and do not challenge our national security. I disagree. So there's plenty of people in the U.S. itching. Kelly's had a very human, very strong anti-legalization. He went before the Congress in March and he said, look, I sit there, we have the equipment, we can identify most of the drugs heading towards the United States. If we capture them at sea, it doesn't involve huge numbers of people. You don't get into big military things. That's the easiest, quickest way to stop it. And I sit by and I have no resources and I can take out 5% of what's coming across because I haven't been given resources because we're involved in legalization. And this has reached the point where in the Central American region, you have, let me reference here something immediately on the agenda. I want people to go and either look at again or look, if they haven't seen it before, what Mr. LaRouche's answer was as conveyed by Dennis last night on the video conference when asked about this. And because what LaRouche posed the problem as the question of what do you do with the youth, right?
Right.
Where do you get the drug problem from? Where do you get the immigration problem from? It comes from a youth on both sides of the border who have no future. And he said we have to be able to give to, for example, to U.S. children and youth, he said, have been made stupid deliberately. They've been given no chance to discover. They've been told what to do. They've been given no chance to discover. We have to give them a mission, and we have to redo that. Now, I'll tell you, there are people in the president of Honduras has given in the last week two major calls for the U.S. to join with him on giving the youth a future. He gave an interview to Excelsior in Mexico. It was published on Monday, which I found very moving. Because one of the things he said is, look, you have certain officials in the United States who are talking about drugs as a problem of health and the cost of rehabilitating an addict or not. He said, he was talking about the legalizers when he said that. No one's against rehabilitating addicts here. That's not the problem. The problem is people who limit it to the question of, it's just a health problem. He said, for us in here, it is a matter of dying. We have lost 2 to 3 generations to the Maras. Now, the Maras is the name of one of the worst drug gangs available. It came out of George Bush's drug wars. It was a drug gang exported from the people running crack cocaine. The gangs, remember, Michelle, you know this, right? When the crack cocaine was introduced big, I think it was
1986.
Yeah, in a sudden, in a 3-month period, crack was thrown into the situation. Came from George Bush directly off the Iran-Contra, speaking of the Mujahideen, let's throw that in there, right?
Right.
Operation. And that gang structure in Los Angeles was then deported back to El Salvador, to Honduras, to Guatemala, the three countries that are most doing it. And when you're talking about Maras, you're talking about children, because they are largely children who have, at the ages of 11, 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, killed so many people because they've been turned into beasts under the direct control of the drug trade, that they are capable of stopping a public bus driving down the streets of the capital of Honduras, getting on, demanding a war tax, and anyone who didn't pay, killing, by, you know, letting the people who paid off the bus and then burning alive the others in the bus. Beheadings has been a major thing. I mean, I'm just going through this because you have to understand why people would flee. So the president of Honduras reviewing this, that 2 to 3 generations have been lost, children, to this thing, said, look, we have to have U.S. support like the U.S. provided to Colombia, which stopped the drug trade cold.
Okay, let's zero in on that period because, you know, look, this picture is so dismal, which is why the BRIC meeting, the cooperation, the development, the realization after 40 years of a development bank to kick out what the IMF became of. And, you know, the IMF was not intended by Franklin Roosevelt to be this dictatorship that it became under British rule, but to replace with development. This is such a alternative from the heavens, if you will, to bring us out of this crisis. But I think something needs to be re-emphasized. We all said it, but listeners, you really have to digest this. The kind of crisis from the youth fleeing from Central America, the hell that Viktor Ivanov described. This I didn't know this figure that Roger Moore just told us. 1 million drug-related deaths in Eurasia, in less than 1.5 decades. That is unbelievable. This is phenomenal, and it's pretty much covered up. What I want to emphasize is this is all top-down. Yep. Let me say a few things about it. 1800s, opium trade, Bank of Hong Kong and Shanghai, today known as Hong Shang Bank. Or, oh, you know what? That we made that a bad word, so they changed it to a bunch of initials. Nobody knows what it means. HSBC. HSBC all over New York. Well, that stands for Hong Kong and Shanghai during the time of the British Opium Wars. Biggest drug money laundering bank in the United States of America. No criminal charges. Nobody went to jail. This is Obama and Eric Holder. This is British occupation of the American presidency. Okay, what did they do? In 1977 or so, the British decided time to break America the way we did during the Civil War. How are we going to do it this time? Through banking. For the first time in the history of United States sovereignty, which was, you know, up in the air for many years until Abraham Lincoln brought us the greenbacks and so forth, a foreign bank could come into the United States and take over the banking system. And Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank targeted a small bank in the United States, Marie Midland. They were the first foreign bank in the United States. It was step one in globalization. It was step one.
Can I interject something just very briefly, Michelle?
Sure.
I was in Buffalo. That bank, Marine Midland, actually was not such a small bank. And I was in our offices in Buffalo for that part of the second half of the 1970s. And what was going on there, and this is classic of how London took over the U.S. financial system, took over the dollar, in the course of the 1970s after Bretton Woods. That bank, Marine Midland, and our office was literally across the street from the tower of Marine Midland.
Oh, wow.
The HSBC tower. That bank was the bank, Panama had a dollar-based currency. That bank was de facto used, presumably by the Federal Reserve in New York, in any case, to manage Panama's dollar economy. The British and the forces that they were allied with in Wall Street were preparing the 1970s shift coming off of marijuana and all the people, the fuzzy people that Gretchen, I'm sure, still remembers from the Medellin cartels, the marijuana cartels, and they're preparing the 1980s cocaine boom that, as we mentioned in 1986, became the crack cocaine boom in the American ghettos and the creation of a high-power, high-weapon street gang infrastructure in the United States. HSBC took over that bank as part of creating, with the Caribbean offshore bases, for handling the actual cash flow from what became the 1980s cocaine economy. And if you remember 2012, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, they were investigated for all this massive transfer of cocaine-soaked dollars from Mexico back into the U.S. and delivered to Timothy Geithner in 2007-2008 at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It was about 8 billion banknotes from smuggled back into Mexico from the retail trade in the U.S. and then brought by HSBC up to New York and turned over to Timothy Geithner. What was the bank in New York that became the second big bank they took over? Republic National Bank of New York. They took it over in 1999. That was an incredibly scandal-ridden bank that they took over in 1999 for going into the next phase of globalization and everything that went on that we now know with the horror stories of the cocaine trade and the drug gangs and the youth gangs and et cetera, the deprivation. This was the infrastructure. This was an infrastructure. The little guys and the street gangs and so forth are the mere expendable trash for the people who accumulate by now the trillions alone from the cocaine trade over these decades, 80s, 90s, 3.5 decades of building up a cocaine economy, a consumption economy and a production economy, and then laundering through banks for the higher level top-down controllers. And the fact that there were no prosecutions, this has to explode somehow, not the issue per se of prosecutions, but this infrastructure has to be exposed in the context of coming off the bricks. And that's what Viktor Ivanov does. Viktor Ivanov never wastes a speech where he doesn't talk about Wachovia Bank, remember that, 2010?
Sure.
Eric Holder didn't prosecute that bank either, and it was on his turf. It wasn't George Bush. The laundering might have gone on under George Bush Jr., but it was Eric Holder who cut the deferred prosecution agreement that said, oh, we're not going to arrest you for anything. You're going to pay a fine. And then, of course, Eric Holder and Obama, they did the HSBC deal with a $1 billion fine.
Which is a joke.
Money to pay off the lawyers,
right,
who kept them out of jail.
Right.
So
I want to go to one other notorious case, and we got to give this to Gretchen because it's dear to her heart. She wrote this special report on the team with EIR, and that is the Richard Grasso Abrasso with the FARC. I mean, this was completely obvious, and it just indicates that the United States has been losing its sovereignty. If there is any pathetic country that has been losing its sovereignty over the last decade, or actually now more, 8 years of George Bush, 5 years of Barack Obama, it's the United States, and it's time for the citizens under the leadership of the LaRouche movement to clean this mess up. But when the Honduran president says, help us like you helped Colombia, I guess he really needs to know that how hard the fight was that the LaRouche movement actually led the United States to do the right thing in Colombia. So take it away, Gretchen.
Well, that's we had a friend in Colombia who was the former head of the army who was told there was a fight in 1999 directly between our forces and Grasso, of the head of the Wall Street Stock Exchange.
Right, the New York Stock Exchange,
right.
Exactly.
And Madam Albright was on the side of Wall Street. And so you had a whole project right then to legalize the FARC, which is the narco-terrorist cocaine cartel that centered in Colombia. They had it all going. They sent down Richard Grasso. It was arranged by the State Department to go down to this part of Colombian territory. They hugged with this head of finance, with of the FARC. And Richard Grosso came back, and I heard him personally because I was on the line with the telephone conversation where he said, and I hope to be able to bring the head of the FARC to walk down the halls of Wall Street with me, because we're going to we're talking great investment here of capital. That same time, 3 months, you had General McCaffrey, who headed the anti-drug office, and he said, "This is blood money, and you cannot legalize this blood money." And we brought up to Washington that September, the former head of the Colombian Army, General Bedoya, who was a very strong nationalist, a man who just understood he wanted to develop his country, and he hated the drug trade. And he was told by British agents down in Colombia, "Oh, don't come up with the LaRouche movement, because you won't get anything done." And he came for 1 week. He had more meetings. He was absolutely, completely exhausted. He had some meetings in Congress, with the press, with foreign diplomats, with American citizens, with everybody. I was told personally by American military people that his presentations were critical. And out of that came the decision that the U.S., we won that battle at that case, at least at the level that the U.S. came in and provided support, including its intelligence agent support. That surveillance stuff,
right.
You can't direct it on somebody, and provided them, and they have almost knocked out the FARC. But let me just come back to where we are today, because I've been working on Ibero-America for a number of years, and it's been horrible. It's been very painful. It's because the strategic intervention that screwed that region up was the drug trade. In other words, they were moving together. They were talking about development. They was going to build a Bank of the South, right? They were cooperating. They were interested with the LaRouche movement, and it all fell apart on the grounds that what moved in was George Soros, Tony Blair, and the drug trade. And we had drug governments, and it was a totally bleak situation. And that agenda has been overturned already, right? And that is before the United States follows Viktor Ivanov's suggestion, because the head of the Russian anti-drug agency, people have to get this, has been in Washington, and in Buenos Aires, Argentina, has called for Glass-Steagall as the way to wipe out all this drug banking that has seized control of us. Because you do that, I mean, it's what LaRouche told people, when he discussed with Colombian military people that came up to meet with him all these years. He said, "Look, the drug trade is nothing but this. It's nothing but money. It is anti-production. It's destruction. You knock out the money laundering, and it's worthless. It's meaningless. It collapses, because that's the basis for it." And this comes back to what Lynn was saying, what LaRouche was saying on the immigration crisis. The mere moving in of the big guys, of China, India, and Russia in South America with an invitation, "Join us. Okay, we're going to overturn this world order." And they're not clear on everything, and they're not perfect, but they say, "Let's join together and end this order." That has changed the agenda in the region. And the people have already, it already has begun. So then when the Honduran president on Wednesday, the foreign minister on Wednesday, says at an international conference that they're holding on the immigration crisis, "We need a Marshall Plan." And the president says, "We want ARA to have a frontal assault on the drug trade." You can see, in the context then of the Chinese private company is going and it's got a commitment with the Nicaraguan government, which Nicaragua is right next to Honduras, to build a transoceanic canal, right, which has been planned for more than 180 years. And was the incredible thing there is the Nicaraguan president, in announcing that they've picked the route with which they're going to build this, and they want to start production in December, he was holding up a study produced in 1896 in the United States.
Wow.
Right, for that canal. But we didn't do it. But why do we get in on it? Between that canal, which creates 200,000 immediate jobs, the building of it, and you get the World Land Bridge, coming down, right, from across the Bering Strait.
The New Silk Road.
Right, the New Silk Road, coming down through the United States, down through to get between North America and South America. You have to cross through Central America. Right. You put that land, that railroad through there, you transform the region, and we recover those generations. Some children we will have to just take care of because they've been so destroyed.
Right.
But all those that have not been so destroyed, we pull together, and oh my God, I mean, the potential
is tremendous. Yeah, let me tell our listeners about subscribing to EIR and our phone number, toll-free phone number, 1-800-278-3135. Again, 1-800-278-3135. Many of you follow us on the internet, on our websites and so forth, but know that the EIR is available. It is a weekly magazine, internet magazine now, electronic edition. Used to be in print, but now we are electronic, but it's over 50 pages every single week with the raw material, the documentation, the maps, the speeches, everything we've been talking about today is there for before your eyes every single week. So 1-800-278-3135. If you're not a subscriber, please call and look into it. This is, you know, really the whole BRICS proceedings will be available over a period of weeks. You mentioned this incredible new Nicaragua canal across Central America. Wasn't there also a meeting where a top official from Guyana explicitly talked about the fight for Glass-Steagall here in the United States? When was, you know, there's so much going on. When was that?
That was at the Organization of American States' an emergency meeting of foreign ministers 2 weeks ago.
Right here in Washington.
In Washington, right.
Right,
which was called by Argentina to discuss the fact that the vulture funds, which is the worst of London and the worst of Wall Street, are attempting to drive Argentina in to isolate it and force it into default. And so what Argentina has been doing is going out and organizing. It's got support of half of humanity behind it. The BRICS have backed it. All of South America, Central America, and Mexico. Everybody at that meeting but the United States and Canada supported Argentina because it's a question of just simple
simple reality, among other things.
Right. And reality and anti-usury, you know. Mm-hmm. And usury still is one of the however many sins there are. But at that time, the last foreign minister to speak was the foreign minister of Guyana, a fellow named his first name was Ben. It was his last name. And he's speaking away, total support for Argentina, and then he said, I think at this time, I want to place on our agenda the restoration of the Glass-Steagall law, banking separation law of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because we have come too far to allow the speculators, and I think that the U.S. Congress, I call on the U.S. Congress and the American people to consider reinstating that, and that should be on the agenda of the Americas. So that was a bombshell,
right,
frankly.
Well, I just want to say again, as I said at the beginning, our job, our purpose, or our vision in doing these LaRusso talks is to get America on the right side. And as Gresham just mentioned, Glass-Steagall, the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was a fixed exchange system which limited, almost eliminated, the Brits were the British Empire was furious that they couldn't speculate against sovereign currencies. John Quincy Adams and the policies of the early American founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton's National Development Bank, National Bank of the United States, these are the real American traditions, and these are what we have to bring back. We don't have that much longer, less than 10 minutes. I want to go to something really important, which is the kind of programs that can work. And again, Viktor Ivanov has been a visionary, an organizer, I hope we get to see him sometime in the United States, and he gets invited here.
I mean, get the sanctions off.
Get the sanctions off, but you know, really have him come to the United States and be given a you know, a large venue to present these ideas. But he had a rainbow program, Roger, that you can talk about a little bit, that was geared to Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, in 2010, Pino Alarpi, the Italian former head of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, who was in 2010 in the European Parliament, and Viktor Ivanov collaborated. There was a series of meetings, there was a series of general conferences, and out of this came a proposal in the European Parliament, but also came the Russian proposal called Rainbow 2. Of course, Ivanov now, in his agenda, what had been the agenda for the G8, was calling for Rainbow 3. But basically, what this would have been was would have been an actual combination of counter-narcotics policy, including on the money laundering side, and including seizing the accounts of landowners who had subcontracted farmers for poppy plantings, and you know, the beginnings of the Eurasian heroin economy. I think the most interesting thing to emphasize is the economic development perspective that was associated with this. They call it alternative development, and they, that is now the BRICS presumably, but certainly the Russians, want this on the agenda of the United Nations and the United Nations Security Council, that the Security Council makes a decision with fully congruent with laws and tasks of the United Nations to shut down these two small areas of the world where two big products and trillions of dollars of criminal money is generated. That is the cocoa fields and the poppy fields of Afghanistan. You shut down those two areas. To do it, though, you need economic development. And Ivanov tasked Pino Alarki is unfortunately no longer in the parliament, but and the European bureaucracy in Brussels killed the arrangement. We were personally told by Pino Alarpi that after the collaboration with Viktor Ivanov, the Russians did their job, they were ready to go, and the European Commission killed it. They just didn't make any money available for that, which had been the Russian Rainbow 2 and Alarpi's version in the European Parliament as a proposal for the European Commission to implement. We're paying the price for that now. In the last months, Ivanov had tasked the Institute, the Moscow Institute for Demography, Migration, and Regional Development. It's a think tank in the Russian Federation. It's headed by Yuri Krupnov, who, by the way, had speeches delivered at our conferences, the Schiller Institute conferences. He's always sending greetings whenever the Schiller Institute does conferences. And he's outlined a program of dam building in Afghanistan, between Afghanistan and Tajikistan, and a building of a railroad, north-south railroad, that would combine with what is known as the Indian-Siberia Railroad, which might be a project that comes up on the BRIC agenda, I don't know, but is certainly something in discussion. And his proposals are to create, with forced industrialization, creating the infrastructure first, and then creating actual industries in both the chemical and the mineral processing area, not merely mining and other things, and to provide alternative employment when one comes in, and then one debates how does one do it, how quickly does one do it, one basically shuts down the poppy plantings. Pino Arlaki was the head of in 2001 of the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime. He negotiated personally with the then Taliban government, which was up to its neck also in this legacy of heroin trafficking. And the Taliban government in 2001 banned poppy planting. And lo and behold, there was no poppy planting. And then what happened at the end of 2001? Well, we had 9/11, however you want to spin that one. And we've had a boom perpetually going on with some ups and downs to this day, where Afghanistan now was 30-plus to 40-plus times compared to 2001. That's who Pino Alarpi was. And his plan was to shut down in 2001 and to come in with development aid, but actual development aid for infrastructure and subsidized products, agricultural products, so that the farmers of Afghanistan would not go back to planting poppies. They get more money than they do planting wheat and other things, but they only get maybe 1% of the $80 billion, the conservative figure, of the Eurasian opium economy based in Afghanistan. So Ivanov has this development agenda. I think the Russians, Chinese, and Indians have the chance now as a proof of principle of how to combine counter-narcotics with economic development.
Roger, we are just about out of time. I want to finish with one thing from the latest EIR, which is part of a article by Helga Zepp LaRouche, founder of the Schiller Institute 30 years ago. And she has put out this article, very beautiful, called The New Silk Road is Creating a New Just World Economic Order. Helga says, the world is in flames in Ukraine, in the Gaza Strip, in Iraq, and Syria, in several African countries and elsewhere. Thousands are being murdered. Without the Western community of values, in quotes, deeming it necessary to name the culprits or to stop their actions. The new international economic order, which is coming into existence through China's New Silk Road policy, offers a real alternative, which is in the vital interests of Germany, which she mentions because that's her national country, and in which hopefully the United States will participate if it ditches its imperial policy based on the Anglo-American special relationship and returns to its identity as a republic and constitutional states. There is reason to hope that will happen. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Gretchen. We are out of time. Next week, the following weeks, we're going to talk about fusion power. We're going to talk about the world renaissance in nuclear power and the follow-through on the BRICS meeting and the new just world economic order. Thanks.
Thank you.